and good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Acton. Glad you could join us. This fall, Minnesotans will be electing a U.S. senator. The seat is currently held by Republican Rod Grams, and Minnesota Democrats have been eager to defeat Senator Grams. First, though, they have to decide who's going to run against Senator Grams, and they have a wide field to choose from. There are attorneys and former attorneys and state senators and a doctor and probably a former congressman running. And now there's also a woman in the race, Minneapolis businesswoman Rebecca Yanish, formally announced yesterday that she, too, is a candidate for the DFL Senate nomination. Rebecca Yanish grew up on a farm in the Red River Valley. She married and had a child when she was only 19, worked her way through college as a single mother, came to Minneapolis, worked her way up to become director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency. She's currently on unpaid leave as executive director of the Ryan Construction Company. As part of our Meet the Candidate series here on Minnesota Public Radio, Rebecca Yanish has come by our studios today to talk about her campaign and take your questions. So we invite you to give us a call. It's a great way to learn more about who she is and where she stands on the issues. Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thank you very much, Gary.
Now, let me get one thing clear right away. How do you pronounce your last name?
Yanish.
Okay. Because
well, actually, even within my husband's families, there are about two or three different ways of pronouncing it, but I say Yanish.
All right. Why'd you enter the race? Why'd you decide to run?
Well, it was a long, thoughtful decision. I was initially recruited by some women and friends of mine who said that we really did need a strong businesswoman to take on Rod Grams this fall. And what it came down to for me, though, in my decision was just looking back at my past in my life and realizing I bring the type of real-life experience to this race that none of the other candidates have. And the issues I've cared about through my professional life and personal life are really fundamental issues that all Minnesotans are concerned about right now. And those are education, health care, housing, and especially the farm crisis.
Mm-hmm. Let's get this out of the way right away. Should it matter that you're a woman? The only woman running for the U.S. Senate?
Well, it certainly is part of the perspective that I bring to the race. I will look different than the other candidates. I do think it's important to look at the Senate overall. And if you say, okay, there's 100 senators right now and 91 are men, does that truly represent the population of the United States? You know, the answer is no. So I think there are some benefits for bringing a woman's perspective there. But what I do hope to bring is not just that, but my whole life experience and my commitment to truly represent the people of the state of Minnesota.
I know, I assume that you have lots of disagreements with Senator Grams, but why is it that you think you're the best Democrat for this race? Is it because of your life experiences?
Yes, and that's it in a nutshell. Having worked my way through college, I certainly understand the importance of a good education. The work I was doing before I started college, I was getting paid less than minimum wage. And as I was working my way through college, I can still tell you right now, Gary, what a loaf of bread and a quart of milk cost in 1974. Because I was counting my pennies to make sure my daughter and I, could have the basic food to get us by. So, I look at that and I think, yes, those types of experiences make me different than the other candidates, and I think give me a perspective that's important for the people here.
Mm-hmm. I know people don't like labels, but they're helpful in a way. How would you label yourself on that old traditional liberal to conservative continuum?
Well, I think actually I'm towards the center of that continuum. And really, when I talk about the issues I care about on the social issues of education, housing, health care, I'm certainly on the more liberal side, but the balancing factor is my background in finance. And actually also having owned my own business, I'm very aware of tax impacts and bureaucracy. And so as I look at how to achieve the social policies that I want to advance, I'm going to be very cautious and careful about how we pay for those programs.
Are you going to run in the primary in September, even if you don't get the party endorsement in June?
Well, you know, I fully intend to be the victor on September 12th, and I really hope to do that with the party endorsement. At this point, I haven't had the chance to talk to the DFL delegates. You know, obviously other candidates have been working for about a year in wooing the delegates, but the other side of it is we won't actually know who the delegates will be until probably March 12th. So I need an opportunity to get in there and tell them my story and get a reaction and hopefully convince them that I will be the best candidate.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Yanish is our guest this hour, the latest DFLer to join the race for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Rod Graham. She's come by today to talk about her campaign, her stand on the issues. And let me give you the phone number again. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Sean, your question, please.
I was wondering, do you favor most favored nation trading status for China? Why or why not?
You know, on the China issue, I look back to, again, my experience in business school and through the economics department, and I do believe we are a global economy. So I do believe that we need to act as a global economy, too, and open trade whenever we can. But along with that comes the struggle of recognizing, you know, the need for greater human rights, labor practices, and protection of environment. You can't have those discussions unless everyone's at the table, so I do believe that we need to make the steps forward to initiate our open trade with China and continue to work on the other issues.
Whenever the U.S. has talked at all about labor standards, human rights, and the rest, representatives from many of the lesser developed countries have howled in protest because basically taking the position, well, all you folks are doing in the West is trying to protect your own. You've already got yours, and now you just want to keep us down.
Right.
How do you respond to that? I mean, on the one hand, you have legitimate concerns about labor conditions and the rest. On the other hand, it seems like they have a pretty legitimate argument they want to develop.
And, you know, I think that we're actually focusing the attention on the wrong argument here. You know, when we talk about enacting all these changes only through how we manage and regulate trade, what we really should be looking at is our past practices through the State Department in providing aid to third world countries. I mean, there's programs like microloan programs where the United States could actually be increasing its participation in the third world countries instead of the national trend of doing less and less in foreign aid. When I talk about a microloan program, you know, for a loan of, you know, $50 or $100, you could help, you know, a small entrepreneur start their own bakery, buy enough flour for the day to be able to do their own bakery. And it's assistance that way that helps raise the bar and raise the standards and does it in a way where it's not an adversarial discussion of the United States trying to impose its standards or its way of life on these other countries, but instead helping them lift themselves out of poverty with other aid. And I think if you approach it that way, it releases some of that tension and antagonism that goes along with the trade discussions. So let's try to package it differently and do it in a way that everyone wins.
Bob, your question, please.
Ms. Yanish, do you support or do you oppose ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty? In addition, do you support or do you oppose deployment of a national missile defense system, which critics have characterized as Star Wars light? Please explain your position on these two critically important issues.
Oh, thank you for asking. Well, I think, you know, again, I look at how I came to my decision to run for the Senate, and one of them was just how disgusted I was with Senator Graham's on the whole test ban treaty vote and his actions there. I think it's crucial that the United States steps up and participates in that ban. On the Star Wars issue, you know, there's a lot of discussion about our defense budget and how we handle it. You know, I think, and again, I've mentioned my finance background and business background, and, you know, my goodness, I can't imagine many people who could look at the economics of that system and say this makes sense. It's just, it's ludicrous, the millions and millions of dollars that have been spent on weapon systems that have no you know, proven cost-benefit analysis there. So I would vote against the Star Wars system. I would actually transfer some of the resources defense is spending there and actually make sure we're paying our people in the Army and Navy and Air Force enough salaries so they don't have to live on food stamps. Let's invest in the people that are protecting our country instead of, you know, weapons that, you know, may be ineffective or way too costly.
Overall, do you think we're spending about the right amount on defense? Should we be spending some more, maybe a little less, a lot less? What do you think?
Well, I get frustrated when I look at the amount of the defense budget as our total national budget. And again, it's from the perspective of someone for over 20 years has been an advocate for issues of people, like affordable housing and good quality jobs. So I've seen the defense budget be increased often at the cost of support for affordable housing programs. I guess until I get into it deeper and look at the line by line, again, my perspective is there's been a lot of our national resources dedicated to defense. I would look at transferring some of that away from some of the weaponry systems and possibly even closing more military bases and facilities and really say, you know, can't we be doing better on the human issues, the working family issues?
Back to the phones. Mike's on the line with a question for Rebecca Yanish. Mike?
Hi, thank you. Rebecca, as in your former capacity with the MCDA, you presided over a decision to help Target finance a project downtown to build an office and store complex that, in my opinion, destroyed an area of downtown that was thriving and had some charm and some character. I'd like to hear you defend that.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up, Mike. You know, and we should actually clarify, the city of Minneapolis supported development of the Target store between 9th and 10th Street on Nicollet Mall. There was no public subsidy or public assistance whatsoever in the decision for Target to retain their headquarters downtown and build on the block between 10th and 11th Street. That was strictly a private decision, and there are many in the city who felt that the retention of 5,000 to 6,000 jobs there in that block downtown was very important. In the public testimony about redevelopment on South Nicollet Mall, you know, this is an area that the city's been trying to focus on for over 20 years, and there's a lot of business owners that were down in that area who stepped forward and talked about the problems that historically have gone on in that area with, you know, vagrants and empty storefronts and rundown buildings. So there's certainly both sides of looking at it, but I think the important emphasis here is the fact that Target invested privately in a headquarters and kept many thousands of employees in the downtown, which I think helped downtown become healthy. On the note of the impact of the neighborhood, I know a lot of neighborhood residents were concerned about the design impact of the tall office building, and you know, Target officials work closely with the community, provide an alternative design, a setback further back away from the corner of Nicollet and 11th that increased and enhanced the PV Plaza, kitty corner from the building. So many people who were initially quite concerned, I think, felt much better after working together with Target to change the design.
Do you think your performance as MCDA director is relevant to the Senate campaign?
Well, Well, I think it's relevant in a couple of areas. The fact that I was appointed to that position and held it for 4 years, you know, certainly talks to my experience in working in a highly political arena. The MCDA, going back to the last question, I mean, that really demonstrates that any development decision in a built environment is going to be controversial. And there's always many different stakeholders that view different aspects of a decision. And I think that's actually the skill of being able to listen to all those different voices, try to find good solutions, and move forward. Those are the kind of skills that are very necessary in Washington, D.C.
Adam, your question, please.
Ms. Janisch, when you were at MCDA, you and your agency awarded Ryan Development development rights worth millions of dollars. And then as soon as you left MCDA, you took a job with Ryan Development. Now, to me, that suggests at least the appearance of something unsettling, a quid pro quo. I mean, I can't imagine Ryan would have given you the job if the MCDA hadn't been friendly to them when you were running the show. So I'd like to hear you comment on that, and I'd also like to know if you would support federal laws that would prevent government officials from doing exactly what you did.
You know, the question really highlights, I think, the misperception of where the conflict of interest laws really are. You know, when I came to Ryan, I strictly adhered to the local policy here that you don't do business with a city for a year after you leave the public employ. And that's a policy that I did stick to. And so the question of, you know, was there an appearance of impropriety, you know, I think is really, you know, There's really no basis for that. There was no business that I did with the city of Minneapolis in that first year. The other part of it, too, you know, I had many job offers, and I felt very good about it in a number of different areas after I left the MCDA. I chose to work with Ryan because of the redevelopment work that they do. I mean, they're a national recognized expert in cleaning up old polluted sites. Including the site they cleaned up in Northeast Minneapolis, where there's now a new 400,000 square foot shopping center that the residents of Northeast Minneapolis before had been, in need of a large grocery store, and Ryan stepped forward and got that done. So I say overall, yes, I thought carefully about my decision to work for Ryan. I weighed it against the other job offers I had, but I felt my commitment to redevelopment could best be carried forward in a national firm that already had the commitment to continue that work also.
Other half of his question was, would you support federal legislation involving the so-called revolving door, people moving back and forth from private industry to public service?
Well, on a federal level, if it's a federal job, I'm sure they already have those policies in place. Since I was employed on a local level, I think the city of Minneapolis has, over periods of time, reviewed its conflict of interest policy and has decided that this one-year waiting period is an appropriate policy, and that's what I adhere to.
I should note, by the way, I misidentified you. Your job at Ryan, you're not the executive director,
no.
For Pete's sake. You're the executive vice president. Sam, your question, please.
Yes, thanks for taking my question. I understand that, of course, many groups, neighborhood groups especially, have complained about a lack of low-income housing in Minneapolis. And as a neighborhood activist, I was wondering, as chair of the MCDA, if some of that housing was torn down when you were in that post, and what you would do as a senator to help with that problem of low-income housing.
Yeah. You know, thanks for the question. On the most visible housing that was torn down under my watch was actually as part of the Holman litigation that was done through the Minneapolis Public Housing Agency, which is separate from the MCDA. Under my watch, we actually renovated, stabilized, or constructed 4,000 units of affordable housing, which was more on an annual basis than all other cities in the state combined. So I feel very proud of that record. On the federal level, and again, my background in working in affordable housing for over 20 years, I personally have been very dismayed at how the federal government has walked away from affordable housing issues. You know, over 20 years ago, when I was helping develop Section 8 housing, the federal government in the 80s stopped that program, and what's happening now is those projects that were developed under that program are being converted only for private use, no longer affordable housing. I mean, that is just a problem that, again, the federal government is not stepping up and recognizing, and I really want to be a strong advocate to change that program in the future.
Joan, your question, please.
Thank you. Is it true that you and your husband contributed nearly $20,000 to the Sarah Jane Olson Defense Fund?
Sarah Jane Olson and Fred Peterson have been friends of my husband and I, actually, since I first moved here to the Twin Cities and after when they met and got married. My husband provided money to help raise bail for Sarah so she could be home with her family while she awaited her trial.
Okay. Jill, you're next.
Yes, I was wondering if you would have voted against the banking reform bill, which would have allowed banks and insurance companies to merge.
Well, I felt that the banking reform bill was something whose time probably had come. When you look at our banking policies and say that there were, some of them were 70 or 80 years old, that really doesn't reflect our economic environment here today. So on the whole, you know, I felt that it was probably past time to look at reforms there. But I do have to confess I haven't reviewed the bill line by line and can't comment on all aspects of it.
Tax cuts. Senator Grahams has been a strong advocate for across-the-board tax cuts. Given the projections, anyway, of a big budget surplus, would you support some tax cuts if you were elected senator?
Well, the very first tax program that I'd look very closely at is expansion of our earned income credit that really targets tax incentives to working families. And I think before we look at a broad, across-the-board tax cuts, we really have to say, what are we doing to reduce that disparity between the wealthiest people in this nation and the working poor? Because there's a lot of folks out there that are still struggling to get by. And at the lower end of the income spectrum that aren't benefiting fully from our increased and strong economy.
Mm-hmm. Anything more you do along those lines other than expanding the earned income tax credit? Anything else you have in mind?
Well, what I would look at as priorities, again, are the areas that I've indicated as my top concerns. You know, have we fully and completely invested in our education programs? Can we be doing more to help train qualified teachers and reduce classroom size? You know, I would certainly make a high priority of getting some good health care reforms in place. And again, here, my goodness, we've been talking for 8 years on a national level about changes to health care and can't figure it out. You know, if we have the money in place now, let's move forward and get those reforms in place. Again, housing programs, as the other caller pointed out, you know, why has the federal government walked away from affordable housing? Shouldn't we be investing in that first before we talk about sending money back to the wealthy? I mean, those are the questions I want to raise.
Mm-hmm. Critics might suggest that all of those programs sound good, but they cost a lot of money. And even though we may be relatively flush in Washington, long-term, spending that much, or spending a lot of money on all of those programs, would get us back into trouble again. Do you think we should be spending that money, even if it might endanger the balanced budget?
I really see this investment in education, healthcare, and housing as investment in our future. I mean, to me, one of the biggest threats of our long-term economic health and growth is lack of qualified workers. If you don't have a skilled workforce or a workforce that's healthy or has access to good housing, you know, how do we continue with the job growth? We have the lowest unemployment rate right now this country's seen in decades. And structurally, that isn't going to change. We don't have a lot of young people entering the workforce right now, and we have a lot of people entering retirement age. So the investment in these programs is really an investment in our future rather than a draining of our systems right now.
So even if we might go back to deficit spending, we should still spend that money?
Well, actually, I won't concede here that it would take deficit spending. I think, again, when we talked about the defense budget, there should be ways to look through and say, you know, how can we reallocate resources? And that's what I'd make as a priority first before I talk about any type of deficit spending. And especially, too, I mean, again, we're talking about tax cuts. Rather than tax cuts, let's talk about investment in the future here.
DFL SAC candidate Rebecca Yanish is our guest this hour, part of our continuing Meet the Candidates series here on Minnesota Public Radio. Great opportunity to find out more about where she stands on the issues, talk about her campaign a little bit. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, the number in the Twin City area is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers in just a moment.
Minnesota Public Radio invites you to the first in a series of Walter Mondale Public Service Lectures. The series is a personal look at the people and the history-making events that shaped much of America's policy. Join us Friday morning, February 11th at 8:30 in the Ted Mann Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Minnesota. Mr. Mondale's first topic will address the civil rights challenge at the 1964 Democratic Convention. The event is free and open to the public. That's Friday morning, February 11th at 8:30.
Yeah, invitation to join us over the noon hour today, and we're going to have some excerpts from a very lively forum that was held last night on light rail transit. Some supporters and opponents got together for a lively debate on the issue of whether, in fact, the state should proceed with plans to build that Hiawatha Avenue light rail line between downtown Minneapolis and the Mall of America. So we'll have some excerpts from that debate over the noon hour today. Sunny skies are forecast for northwestern Minnesota through the afternoon. Clearing skies in central and northeastern Minnesota. It will remain cloudy, though, in the southern half of the state with highs today 20s to low 30s. Clear skies across most of the state tonight with lows single digits in the north to the teens in the south, and sunny to partly sunny tomorrow with highs low 20s in the north, mid-30s in the south, dry and basically sunny on Sunday as well. Twin Cities cloudy this afternoon with a high near 30, clearing tonight with a low 10 to 15, and then tomorrow sunny skies with a high in the low 30s. Our guest this hour midday is the latest DFLer to announce for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. Rebecca Yanish, a Minneapolis businesswoman, has joined us. She is on unpaid leave as executive vice president of the Ryan Construction Company. You might recall that she was the director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency for, was it 4 or 5 years?
4 years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she's come by today to take your questions. If you'd like to find out more about where she stands on the issues, the number to call is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You grew up on a farm in the Red River Valley, so I suppose you've been paying a little closer attention to what's been going on in terms of farm issues than you might otherwise. What should be done about that to help the family farmer? Should we scrap the existing laws, go back to the old way of doing things? What's your solution?
Well, my family has been farming up in East Grand Forks for 5 generations now, and my brother is still actively farming there and actively struggling through the farming crisis right now. You know, the Freedom to Farm Act, I think, has been an incredible failure. You know, it certainly has not targeted the resources to the neediest farmers and helped those in the deepest crisis here. So I think the first step is to scrap that, admit failure, throw it out, really start looking more closely at how can you avoid paying the successful farmers additional federal aid while the neediest farmers, head into bankruptcy. But I think overall, too, it's more just an issue of looking at the individual farm programs, but it's also an issue of what can we do to help sustain our rural communities? Because we need to have choices here. If, in fact, we're getting to a point where it doesn't make economic sense and farmers may want to choose to a different lifestyle or different jobs, we need to make sure those job opportunities are available in the communities in the rural area. And when I look at growing up in East Grand Forks, it meant a lot to me to be able to know that my family and friends can still raise their families in that community and have a prosperous life. So let's see how we can keep some good quality job creation in those communities and provide choices.
On the specific farm programs, without getting into real detail here, one of the basic premises of the 1996 law was that American farmers are the best in the world. Let them compete in the global marketplace, and they're going to do very, very well. Do you think the whole concept was misguided?
Well, the concept was really a discussion of competing on a worldwide basis. But what was really happening is the Republican agenda to just remove the subsidies and support for programs. So I think that the rhetoric was there, but I don't know if there was anything substantial in, looking at if we talk about competing in a world economy, what have we changed? What trade practice have we changed? Can we export more Minnesota goods to France? No. Nothing has changed there. So, again, in theory it sounded right, but I think in implementation it's been a failure.
One of the hot items facing, not only agriculture but society in general, are the GMOs, genetically modified organisms.
Yes.
Should the federal government take a little higher profile on this issue, maybe ban them for a while, put some tighter restrictions on growing GMOs? What do you think?
Well, and that's a tough question, too, because, when you look at the markets, any ban right now is going to have a very severe economic impact on a lot of farmers. So I think that's too drastic a step at this point in time. I think there needs to be better education on what the issues are that surround GMOs. And I think there needs to be some ways of getting that information other than just the seed companies being the one to dispense the information. So the state of Minnesota, I believe now, have had some forums to discuss that so farmers can make an educated decision on whether they want to plant those seeds, use those seeds, or really make some other choices.
Al, your question, please.
Actually, two questions. The first one is real quick. What do you plan to do if you get elected to take care of the dairy compacts? Would you consider filibustering or doing some other radical things like that to try and level the playing field? And the second thing is, what's your plan and your policy on the transportation issue? I know that about 3 or 4 years from now, there's going to be reauthorization of the highway fund again. And I know I don't know if you're with the MCDA, you were involved at all with the Crosstown 35W debacle that's going to be occurring in the next couple of years because they didn't have the willpower to actually do it correctly, and it's going to be pretty much a major rebuild with very little net effect. So I guess what's your plans to deal with transit or traffic issues, I should say?
Okay. On the first question on the dairy compact, I really admire our Senator Wellstone and the stance he took in stepping forward and saying this is an issue that needs to be discussed thoroughly rather than tagged on to other bills, and it's really inappropriate to continue that kind of compact. So I would join Senator Wellstone in doing whatever it takes to get rid of that compact, because it's our dairy farmers really suffer from that pricing strategy right now. On the second impact on transportation issues, there's been a lot of contentious discussion about building more freeways versus light rail transit versus expansion of our bus system. And to me, I really think we need to be thinking broader in how we talk about transportation. I am a supporter of light rail transit, and I am a supporter of having choices in transportation. I'm delighted that the Met Council is talking about busways and other ways of moving people, because anyone who really cares about how our region grows knows that we've got to avoid gridlock, and we don't ever build ourselves out of gridlock through highways alone. I'm really, you know, in my work at the MCDA, we really didn't get into the Crosstown 35W debate, other than I know there was some housing in that area that was threatened by one of the rebuild scenarios, and it was affordable housing, so we were pleased that that didn't need to be taken to, do the rebuild for the Crosstown. But other than that, our agency really wasn't involved in the transportation issues, and my support overall is to get a broader-based transportation system here in the Twin Cities that doesn't just rely on the car.
Connie's on the line from Bloomington with a question for Rebecca Yanish. Go ahead, Connie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I kind of have a several-part question. I'd like to know Ms. Yanish's position on abortion and the partial birth abortion, so-called partial birth abortion ban, and also what would you consider the, how do you define what the product of abortion is? What is removed from the woman's body when an abortion occurs, and is that contingent on the woman's circumstances and her support network at the time?
Okay.
Okay. On the issue of abortion, my stance is really that it's inappropriate for the federal government to be dictating when life begins. I feel very strongly that there are private decisions a woman needs to make with her family, with her doctor, with her spiritual advisor or God, and it should be done on that personal level rather than trying to be mandated by the federal government. So that's really the attitude I take when you talk about, you know, the controversial issues of, you know, partial birth or other issues there, that we really should not be in the business of trying to legislate those personal decisions.
Should the government have any legislation in this area whatsoever?
Well, when it comes to the abortion issue, you know, certainly we have a Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, and I think that stands on its own, and I would just support, again, the action of Roe v. Wade, and to me that's the end of the discussion.
What about end-of-life decisions? Should the government, federal government, get involved in those decisions?
Yeah, you're talking about euthanasia and other decisions like that.
Right.
Well, I think our medical community has some fairly strict standards on that. So, you know, I'm just not really aware of requests for more federal intervention other than the standards that we have through our medical community today.
Abortion is a, as you well know, is been something of a litmus test, really, in both political parties. Should it be people's position on this issue?
You know, it really is unfortunate because when you look at the United Nations dues debate last year, you know, why in the world did abortion become part of a discussion on the United States repaying past dues to the United Nations? You know, I guess that instance itself raise the awareness for a lot of women who are pro-choice women who say, you know, we really need to have advocates in Washington that are pro-choice advocates, and I really agree with that position. But again, it's more an issue of making sure it can be a private decision between a woman and her family and her doctor.
Karen, your question, please.
Yes. Very quickly, I just want to say delighted to be talking to another friend of Sarah Jane's, and thank you for your last answer. And pleased to hear that you are as concerned as you are with human issues, so on a human issue that affects a lot of people in Minnesota, now that Vermont has brought it into the forefront again, what is your stand on same-sex marriage?
My stance is that all couples, all families should have the same legal rights in terms of access to health care, rights as they, you know, whether it's how they file their taxes or inheritance or visitations during a hospital stay, that that shouldn't be, there should not be discrimination there on the legal rights. When it comes to marriage, and again, it gets back to private decisions. When my husband and I took our marriage vows, you know, those were vows we wrote ourselves. They were certainly recognized by the Catholic Church at the time. But again, there is a very personal nature, I believe, to how you define marriage and how you define commitments. And I don't know if the federal government needs to get involved in that definition. I do think it's very appropriate for the federal government to ensure that the same legal rights are available to all couples.
Karen, your question, please. Oops, I guess Karen has gone away here. Let me ask you a couple of foreign policy-related questions, because senators get involved in that a lot. The war in Kosovo last year, did you support U.S. intervention there?
Yes, I did. And I guess my read on that, too, is there... I think it's unfortunate when we're in times of such ethnic struggles there, but it is difficult to sit by the sidelines when you see such human atrocities. And so what I would prefer doing rather than intervening on a military basis gets back to my earlier comments on foreign aid. You know, if we had an earlier intervention on helping alleviate some of the personal misery and poverty, you know, maybe it wouldn't get to the point of the civil unrest that then mandates a military intervention.
Mm-hmm. Ellie and Gonzalez, what about that?
Oh, just send the poor boy home to his father. I just can't believe all the hubbub about that decision. But I look at it and say, and again, you know, from my background of really caring about families, you know, he deserves to be home with his father.
You think we should change our policy toward Cuba? Should we normalize relations with Cuba?
I would be in favor of normalizing our relations there. I mean, my goodness, you know, what has that embargo accomplished other than continuing, you know, poverty within Cuba? I think it's time to get past an old grudge and get on with mm-hmm. relationship there.
Howard, your question, please.
Yeah, I think Rod Grams is a kind of a gutter politician. He took advantage of Jerry Sikorsky's situation when he ran against him, and he's kind of a dirty campaigner, and he's got a lot of money. I know he's vulnerable on a couple of issues, like a vote for to impeach and against the nuclear proliferation treaty. He's a do-nothing, know-nothing guy, but he's going to be tough to beat, especially by a woman. What kind of campaign are you willing to wage against him?
Why do you say especially by a woman?
Well, the last woman that ran against him didn't do very well.
Okay.
Well, this is the year 2000, and I intend to run a very hard, very diligent campaign to convince every voter in the state of Minnesota that I bring a real-life perspective and can be an advocate in a way that Rod Grams has not been able to do over the past 5 years. So I am confident that if I can get my message out on what I've worked through in my past life, you know, the achievements I've gone in my commitment to education, health care, housing, the farm crisis. I mean, those are all issues that Graham's performance has been dismal. So, again, waging a strong campaign, getting my message out, being an advocate for the people, and concentrating on these topics, I think will prevail.
Howard raised the issue of impeachment. How would you have voted on that had you been in the Senate?
I would not have supported the impeachment vote. You know, to me, that was such a huge distraction from the business we should have been paying attention to. You know, why couldn't we have instead been looking at solutions to health care or long-term solutions for Social Security or Medicare? You know, it was such a Republican agenda of discrediting our president that was a distraction that I think just held the whole nation back.
Tom, your question?
Yeah, Rebecca, earlier you said that you were against the defense budget. You thought that we'd spend too much money on weapons with no demonstrable value. You then went on to say that you were in favor of increasing social spendings on a wide variety of topics here. And that is an area where many people believe that not only has there been no demonstrable value, but there's been some negative aspects to that. Rather than just throwing money into the pit, what would you do to ensure that the money does something of value?
Thanks for the question, because again, with my finance background, I am very, very aware of cost-benefit analysis and making sure that there's something of value that comes forward there. And that was the question I was raising on the defense budget, is, you know, have we done that type of analysis for the Star Wars system or some of this weaponry? You know, my perspective from being an advocate for affordable housing and good quality job creation was one of looking at the overall national budget and seeing what an incredibly large portion of that is devoted to defense. So, you know, when it comes to social programs, too, I think we've learned a lot over the years on the different ways that we've tried to fight poverty and support working families. I think the earned income tax credit has been demonstrated as a very effective tool to get the dollars back into the checkbook of the families that most need them, the families that are really struggling to get by and support themselves. So there are ways of looking and evaluating the programs and ensuring that we are making wise investments, and I'm very committed to doing that.
Quick question, Shirley, before we wrap up.
Yes, I would like to know what if she is in favor of universal health care.
You know, at this point, I'm not sure if universal health care is the appropriate solution. There are others in this campaign that certainly have a very strong background in medical service. My perspective is just that we've been talking for way too long about changes to health care, and I haven't seen any changes enacted. So universal health care may be a step too far to one end of the spectrum. We may need to take an intermediate step before we do that. But my commitment is first to make sure we have a way of ensuring, you know, all children to have access to health care, and that we can get some fundamental changes in place soon while we're still in this strong, healthy economy.
How can you get people interested in politics?
Now, that's an unusual question.
Well, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are, and you know, a lot of apathy about this election and many in the past. We don't have a lot of time, and this is kind of an unfair question.
Okay.
But give me your best 30 seconds.
I think you get people involved by relating to them on a very personal level, by being able to talk to them about things they care about, and convince people that their vote, their involvement, really does make a difference. And I think in that race, again, the real-life perspective I bring is something that I hope will energize people, will, you know, make them want to stand up and say, yes, let's get involved in backing Rebecca and make her our next senator.
Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
DFL Senate candidate Rebecca Yanish, who has joined a crowded field of DFLers running for the seat currently held by Republican Rod Graham.